Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you're looking to take a trip to the Big Apple or San Francisco this summer or anywhere and want to save some dough or maybe are looking for something off the beaten track, you could skip the hotel option and shoot for a room in a private home using a website such as Airbnb. It tends to be more affordable, but some cities are cracking down on the practice. Joining us now to talk about Airbnb is Adrian Jeffries, a tech reporter for TheVerge.com. Welcome to the show, Adrian.
Hi, Anne. Thank you.
So we're talking about Airbnb today, but there are other online businesses like this. Can you describe what they do?
Sure. Well, Airbnb is a website that makes it easy for anyone to rent out their apartment or just an extra room or maybe like some extra space they have in the backyard to travelers who are looking for something unconventional. So one of their original taglines was travel like a human. And you can imagine how it can be more comfortable to stay in an entire apartment if you're going somewhere like Paris or New York, some crazy city where you're going to be tired. And a lot of people prefer it to staying in a hotel.
And it does tend to be more economical.
It can be more economical. I would say there's a range. Mm-hmm. I would say there's also, depending on which site you choose, Airbnb tends to be one of the more expensive. You can also find similar arrangements on Craigslist, which tend to be, they're not vetted as well. Craigslist doesn't assume any responsibility, whereas Airbnb has an insurance policy. But the listings on Craigslist can be cheaper, and you can find some really good deals there.
That's what I wanted to know about, is what does set Airbnb apart from. But they're, you know, if I wanted to get a cottage up on Lake Michigan, I just Google cottage Lake Michigan, and there's people who have got a million cottages. But we're not talking about that exactly, are we? It's more like a day or night, a couple nights or three nights.
Yeah,
or...
so it's usually short-term stays, and it's often the person who's renting it to you, it's often their primary apartment, and mm-hmm. they just vacate it and stay somewhere else while you're in town. I know a lot of people who do that in New York, and you can make a little bit of extra money on the side from doing that. So yeah, this is a fairly new thing, and Airbnb has made their website really easy to use. They facilitate the payment transaction. They make sure you have a profile. They make sure you have lots of pictures of the place. So they've really tried to make it really easy, just as easy as booking a hotel.
But you mentioned it's getting more and more popular, particularly in a place like New York. But
right.
There's also some friction with the city about this. Why is the city fighting it?
Right. So San Francisco and New York both have laws that could be interpreted to make this practice illegal. It's common for cities to have ordinances that are intended to protect tourists from staying in dangerous hotels. And so there are extra requirements if you're running a hotel where you've got a lot of strangers coming in and staying for short periods. You have to have extra, you know, numbers of exits. You have to have like extra sprinkler systems. It has to be, the standards for safety are a little bit higher than with a residence.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a law in New York State. New York City happens to be a really popular city on Airbnb, which is why this has become more of a common topic in New York City as opposed to other cities in New York. But it is a state law, and it says that you cannot rent out your property unless the primary resident is home for less than 30 days. So it's intended to prevent illegal hotels. They call it the illegal hotels law.
And it was in
place for many years, but it was just updated in 2011.
Andy, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Good morning, ladies. Just wanted to offer my experience with Airbnb. Last summer, my wife and I took our honeymoon and used Airbnb almost exclusively for our accommodations out in California. And we just had an absolutely wonderful time. The best part of the experience was getting to meet people who were local to the area. We got to use their experience and their knowledge about where we were at to really have a more immersive experience. It was pretty great. It was an amazing time, actually.
What's the difference, though, Andy, for you? Why not just go to a bed and breakfast? I've had the same experience at a bed and breakfast.
First, I would say the cost, because Airbnb offers a much wider variety of costs. We were able to stay near Yosemite National Park for about $40 a night. And that was in an apartment that the gal had built in her garage. She had a large, like, freestanding garage and built a one-bedroom apartment and basically ran it as just that, a bed and breakfast, honestly. It was the same way. It was the same, you know, sort of setup, but she brokered it through Airbnb, and it was inexpensive, and the accommodations were top-notch.
All right. Well, thank you for your call.
Sure. Thank you.
Take care. What about taxes, Adrian Jeffries? Do they pay taxes on the sales when they do this? How does that work?
So that's kind of unclear. I was at a hearing last week for someone who got in trouble for renting their apartment on Airbnb, which is very rare, I should say. Mm-hmm. He rented his apartment to a guest from Russia. Some building inspectors happened to stop by on a complaint, and they issued him a citation. So one question that came up during the hearing was whether or not Airbnb was paying hotel taxes. I'm pretty certain they're not, but in court they said they weren't sure. Mm-hmm. There were some representatives from Airbnb, and they said, oh, we're not sure what the policy is for New York. If they were paying hotel taxes, then that would actually almost certainly mean that they were in violation of the law.
Because they would be attempting
to operate a hotel.
Okay. And do people usually vacate when they rent the room or the apartment?
So there are both types of listings on the site. In my experience, I attempted to find this out with a manual search, and it looks like about half and half. Half the listings are for an entire vacant apartment. Half the listings are for a private or a shared room. So as to which option is more popular, I'm not sure.
When I first heard about this, when someone told me about it, I thought, I don't know if I'd want to just go stay in someone's house who'd advertised online. But there is vetting. Can you tell me about the vetting process?
Sure. So the way Airbnb works is they really encourage you to put a lot of information about yourself on the site. So you've got a picture, you've got a little description of yourself, you've got links to your social media profiles. My account is connected to my Facebook account. So the hosts can also see if we know anybody in common on Facebook. Hmm. It'll say, you know, like your friend Zeb knows this person or has stayed at this place. Besides that, it's really on the users to use common sense and exchange a couple emails, maybe a phone call before they, although Airbnb encourages you to do most of the interaction through the site. But you're encouraged to have some interaction with the host before you book.
Does this tend to be, can Airbnb hosts or hostesses, can they decide whether or not they're going to rent to somebody? In other words, they don't want a family with three kids and a dog, or they don't want to have a single male or something like that, or a single female,
right.
Conversely?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Each host sets the maximum number of guests for the place. And the host also can decline any request for a stay.
Okay.
If they don't like what's in someone's profile, or perhaps that person has left negative reviews in the past for whatever reason.
Daniel, in Columbus, you're on the air. You used Airbnb. Tell us about it.
Yeah. We actually just got back from a trip to South Beach in Miami, where we used Airbnb to book a condo that is on the bay side of South Beach. And the pictures look great. The views look great. And when we got there, it was clear that the condo building wasn't really supporting the idea of renting out rooms. Mm. The host met us outside the gates of the condo, the huge condo complex called the Flamingo. And he met us and said, okay, if anybody asks, I'm your uncle. And when we go through here, tell them you're staying with me. I'm on the 15th floor. This is my number. You're going to be on the 4th floor. Now you want to go in this side over this way because these people don't check your ID, but these people over this side will. And when you go up the elevator, you have to go across the breezeway and through a service elevator near the trash chute. And then when you go in, then here's the place. It was the strangest experience. And then when we got there, it was a one-bedroom condo with futons, and it sort of looked like the pictures, just a lot dirtier. even in the bathroom, and we lifted up the bath mat, and a large bug resembling a roach ran out, and the door of the bathroom was completely covered in dirt, like it had never been cleaned from all the different hands that had opened and closed the door. It was pretty gross. Luckily, when you're in Miami, you don't spend a lot of time where you're staying.
Yeah, but that is an issue, isn't it, Adrian Jeffries, that there are some, particularly if it's in a condo or an apartment building, that's not necessarily acceptable.
Sure, yeah. That's the other thing. It's not always the city that will get you in trouble, but very often landlords say no subletting in the lease.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, if you're renting, that is kind of on you, too. You could get in trouble and get booted out.
So, Daniel, are you going to give a bad review for this place? Because I don't care what. If it's dirty, yuck.
Yeah, absolutely. We will give a bad review. We've used Airbnb before when we went to Austin and had a great experience, great location. It happened to be a friend of a friend that it was their Airbnb, so we had a little bit of more of an in.
Mm-hmm.
But this experience definitely turned us off to making sure we read all the reviews before we stay somewhere.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Well, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
How important, Adrian Jeffries, are all the reviews? I mean, what advice do you give people who are just kind of wading into this now?
The reviews are super important. I would say that is the strength of Airbnb, is being able to look at all those reviews. And Airbnb only allows people to review a place if the site knows that they've stayed there. So you know that they have some experience. I would say if you're looking at a place that has no reviews, you better be getting a discount.
Because there's so many unknowns.
Right.
And what's the insurance for? What does that do?
So the insurance is actually for the hosts, because they're taking on some risk, too, by letting strangers into their homes.
Mm-hmm.
Airbnb has an insurance policy that will protect them from damages if their guests turn out to be crazy and like, say, get things dirty or break things.
Have you done it?
I have, yeah. I stayed in an Airbnb in Paris.
And
it was a great experience. It was clearly an apartment dedicated to Airbnb.
Uh-huh.
The owner lived in an apartment nearby, and it was pretty bare. Some travel books that previous guests had left there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we had a good experience, and we left a good review at the end of it.
Hey, it was Paris, right?
And it was Paris. Yeah.
Right. Well, Adrian Jeffries, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Adrian Jeffries is a tech reporter for TheVerge.com. We'll continue with Tech Tuesday after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Assistive Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is now accepting donations of used computers to be refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. AT Ohio offers a variety of disability programs and services, including a device loan library. Donation information is at atohio.org.
There's more, it turns out, to lending money than just dollars and cents.
We were persuaded to give loans to people who didn't have the means to repay them. So essentially, we were setting people up for failure.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, installment lenders, in the second part of our special collaboration with ProPublica, next time on Marketplace from APN.
This afternoon at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. NPR News is your source for local news, public affairs reporting, and NPR News. Listen for news on 89.7 FM and at WOSU.org.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Every business needs a web presence these days. The era of the yellow pages is just about over. First, it was the website, then Facebook, and probably Twitter as well. And more recently, Pinterest has quickly become one of the top social media sites for businesses. Joining us now to talk about that is the author of a new book called Entrepreneur Magazine's Ultimate Guide to Pinterest for Business. Karen Leland is president of Sterling Marketing Group. She's also blogs for Entrepreneur.com, The Huffington Post, and PsychologyToday.com, among others. I think I have lost my guest, Karen Leland. We will try to get her back in the meantime. Are you a business that uses Pinterest? Give us a call and tell us how you use it. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Again, the number is 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Coming up, we're going to talk with Karen Leland. She is the author of a new book called Entrepreneur Magazine's Ultimate Guide to Pinterest for Business. If you're a business that uses Pinterest in your work, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Hi, Karen Leland. It's Ann Fisher. Sorry about that.
That's all right. Hi, Ann Fisher. How are you?
Fine. Thank you. What sort of advantage does Pinterest in particular bring to a business?
Well, you know, if you look at the demographics, 70% of the people who are on Pinterest are women ages 25 to 44. So if you are a business and you have a business, a product, a book, et cetera, that caters to that demographic, one of the things you know is that your audience is already there. And so it's a great way to sort of narrow it down to where your customers are. So that's one advantage that Pinterest brings.
So, and then I suppose if that's a demographic you want to break into.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's we're always talking about in marketing and branding, you know, finding our audience. Where's our audience? Well, if you know that your audience is already someplace and they're spending time there, then it's a natural that that's where you would go. And if you also look at some of the statistics, the average online order from a Pinterest user is $179 compared to $80 for a Facebook user and $69 for a Twitter user. So we know that not only are those people on Pinterest, but they're spending money.
Well, they like stuff because when I go through Pinterest, they're usually people looking at stuff. Stuff
that
they like, you know, like everything from flower arrangements to funky shoes.
Yes,
I don't know why.
Very heavily, I like that they like stuff. It's very heavily weighted towards fashion, food, home decor, kids. So, you know, again, if you have a business that caters to any of that, Pinterest can be a really powerful place for you to be, not only in terms of building your brand, but in terms of actually getting flow through to your website for sales.
You know, I usually unfriend someone who is constantly promoting something on Facebook because that's not why I use it. And, you know, even if it's somebody I know and like, if they're constantly pushing something at me, I don't want that. How does that work with Pinterest?
Well, that's a really great point. And one of the things that I tell, you know, whenever I start working with a branding or a marketing client who wants to get on Pinterest, one of the things that I say and we talk about in the book is that you have to do certain percentages. So 40% of your pins need to be inspirational and motivational. 40% of your pins need to be educational, and then only 20% of your pins can be promotional or about your brand. If you do more than 20%, then you get exactly what you're talking about, which is people feel like they're being pushed at, promoted, etc., and they will stop looking at you. They'll stop following you as a pinner.
If you have a question for our guest, Karen Leland, she's the author of Entrepreneur Magazine's Ultimate Guide to Pinterest for Business. Question about how to use Pinterest? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Of course, you can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Tom from Columbus, you're on the air with Karen Leland. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Hi there. How are you?
Very well.
I'm very good. Thank you. I just had a question. I'm a small business owner. I own a tree care company in Columbus, Ohio, and I was told at one point that Pinterest will actually change the tags on their images when they're reposted, which loses the, you know, how web engines will crawl the internet. Will it, we lose traffic because we lose the tags on the images that we post. I was just wondering if there's any merit to that.
Well, when you post the image, you write a pin description, and in that pin description, if you're pinning the image from your website, then the URL from your website goes along with the pin. And when you pin the image, you also can write in the pin description about the image, where it came from, and then you have an option of also putting in a URL when you pin it. When other people reap, so it stays for that. When other people repin it, the etiquette is that it goes along with it. Your normal URL that you put in goes along with it, and your description goes along with it. They can, however, change it. Pinterest doesn't automatically change it, but the person who repins it can change it. Although the etiquette is generally to keep it from the original source and to keep that original source quoted. And most people do follow that. So while you do run some risk of that, you know, in general, you run a far greater opportunity for when you're repinned for other people who don't know about you to find you and go back to your website.
Are you guys talking about where they ask you, do you want to copy the location instead of just the picture?
Well, they don't ask if you want to copy the location. Mm-hmm. What happens is the description comes along with it. The description that the original pinner has written goes along. And most people will keep that description or modify it somehow. But in general, most people keep the original link because that's the etiquette.
All right. Thank you, Tom, for that question. We appreciate it. Any other questions? 614-292-8513. You recommend promoting others. And I see that with a lot of social media advice.
Yeah, because social media, it's the word social that makes it, you know, social media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole idea here is really not just to promote your own stuff, but to repin other people's images, to do comments on other people's pins, to promote other people, because it's part of making it that community. You know, one of the big changes that social media has brought about is I think we used to look at everybody else's competition. And even though we still do to some degree, it's recognizing that audiences are interested in more than just one source of expertise. So, for example, like I wrote a time management book many years ago, so I know one of the audiences I'm interested in are audiences that are interested in time management. I will very often do an interview with another time management expert or another author of a time management book, or I'll pin something from another time management expert on my pin board that has to do with time management, because if their audience sees it, they could just as well be interested in what I'm talking about in my book because they're interested in the topic. And so promoting other people and really building a community that's interested around a particular topic is a much more powerful way to get your message out than just making it about, you know, my stuff, me, everything I'm doing, and ignoring everybody else who's in the space.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And once again, I'm talking with Karen Leland, author of Entrepreneur Magazine's Ultimate Guide to Pinterest for Business. How big is Pinterest getting in business?
Well, Pinterest is the third largest social media site after Facebook and Twitter. And the estimates are that by the end of 2013, 90% of the top 1,500 brands in the U.S. will be on Pinterest.
Mm.
So that's pretty significant.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Ali in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Ali.
Hi. I think you answered my second question, which was how many members are actually using Pinterest. My initial question was basically, is Pinterest only for products or is it also for services? And do they focus on like local or is it more like within the whole country or?
Well, those are great questions. First of all, about 48.7 million users are what are currently on Pinterest. And no, Pinterest is not just for products, it's for services as well. You know, there's a whole section of the book that I did on your profession on Pinterest where I go through a bunch of different professions. So you've got realtors using Pinterest, you've got landscapers, you've got interior designers, you've got consultants, you've got all kinds of people using Pinterest. So it is for businesses, for products as well as for services. I think it is not specific to a local area because anybody can come and see your pins. Now, that doesn't mean that someone who is in your area might not find you and use you because you're in their particular area, but it's anybody can see it from all over the world. So one of the great things it does is if you have a product or a service that doesn't have geographic boundaries, Pinterest is a great way to get your message out and pick up customers that don't just live in your local area.
Okay.
Oh, great.
All right. Thank you, Ali.
Thank you. Bye.
The number 614-292-8513. If you have a question, you can also have a question or comment and put it on Facebook, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Kristen. She says, asks, do you have any suggestions on how a university could utilize Pinterest to promote their school? We're not in sales or food, et cetera, so is there even a market there?
Absolutely. So one of the most popular things on Pinterest is education. So whatever particular, if that university has a particular focus, or even just if they were putting out educational things, you can do videos on Pinterest. You can do podcasts on Pinterest. So having, you can do infographics. So having all kinds of informational and educational pins and images is one of the way a university can promote itself. So like, for example, a university might create a infographic for how to, you know, 10 ways to decide the best school to go to, and then they put that infographic up. There's lots of people that would be looking for that information. So just depending on the content they want to focus on, you can absolutely promote a university or a school on Pinterest.
You said to analyze your metrics is one of the suggestions you have. What do you mean by that, and what are you looking for?
Well, one of the great things in the last round of updates to Pinterest that they did was they actually included some Pinterest metrics, so that once you sign up and you do what's called verify your website, you can actually get in and see what kind of statistics you're getting on your Pinterest. And that's things like how many people are visiting your Pinterest, how many people are following you, what pins are getting repinned the most. You know, just take that one simple metric. If you look at which of your pins are getting repinned the most, that tells you something about which of your pins are the most popular, so that you can start to do more pins of that same variety and nature. And so it's like with any social media, you want to look at some of these basic metrics just to get a sense of how is the market, how is the audience responding to what you're pinning, because that allows you to kind of pivot and make adjustments so that you can start pinning more things and going in a direction that can get you a bigger audience and is more what people are looking for.
We had a caller who said she doesn't even understand what Pinterest is. And I would imagine there are businesses that are scratching their heads right now, business owners going, what the heck are they talking about?
Okay, so here's my simple, here's what I always say.
Thank you.
Every January 1st, I sit down with a glue stick and a scissors and a stack of magazines, and I cut out images, and I do like an 8.5 by 11 kind of vision board for the year of what my goals are. Pinterest is sort of like that, except for without the glue sticks. So what Pinterest is it's a series of boards organized around different categories, and you can pick the categories. They have certain categories like fashion, food, you know, et cetera. And then there are images that you pin to those boards that make up that board. So it's really a visual pin board. So remember, if you have ever gone to a public place and there's been a bulletin board and people had pinned postcards to it, that's really what Pinterest is, but it's done all online. It's done all, you know, in cyberspace.
And the categories, you can name them anything you want. Like my party category is named Toga Toga.
Well, you can't name the categories anything you want.
You can name your board what you want. Yeah.
You can give your board a name, but there's a series of categories that Pinterest you have to assign a board to. There's something like, I forget how many categories, 25 or something. But your board, you can name what you want to name it.
Right. And you can have secret boards, too.
You can have up to 3 secret boards, which are boards that are private. So let's say that you were working on brainstorming a project for something in your business, but you didn't want the whole world to see it, just yourself and maybe anyone else you designated. You can designate that a secret or a private board, and then only you can see that board, so you don't have to worry that what you're pinning is being seen by other people.
When did Pinterest reach the point where it became useful to businesses, in your opinion?
Well, I think when it became the third largest social media site, that's when it really became useful to businesses. Because if you're that big and you've got that much of an audience, then what you know is that there is money to be made there. Now, how to make that money or how to drive that traffic is part of the strategy you have to come up with. You know, a lot of what I do when I first start working with a branding or a marketing client is I will spend a lot of time working on what's the strategy, because the strategy is a very important piece of what you have to figure out before you even start jumping in and pinning. But assuming you figure out that best strategy for your business, then, you know, it's another market where you can get the attention of people who potentially can buy your product or service.
You say to pay attention to pin placement. How does that work?
Well, they've done some research. Jeff Bandler out of iTrack Shop did some research about where people's – they've actually tracked where people's eyes go on Pinterest. And what they found is that people's eyes go first to pins that are in the middle. So, for example, like if you pin – you should put your most important pins in sort of the second – around the second row, around the middle area, because that's actually where most people's eyes go to first. So just the way people track, they tend to see that first.
It's interesting because I was in newspapers for many years, and you always wanted that top right-hand column on the
exactly.
front page. You know, so
Similar idea.
Yeah, exactly. I interviewed Robert Anthony, a freelance tech journalist, I think it was last week, who got something like a million hits on his Pinterest or a million followers or something ridiculous in just a matter of a few days. And we were trying to figure out, you know, he's been talking about why he thinks that is. And he says what he posts, he doesn't post a lot, but what he posts is original. And he always brings something to the table where he test drives different kinds of technology and he shows people what he's doing.
Yeah, and I think there's two really important points in that. One is that it's original. So he's not just repinning what everybody else has. He's actually coming up with original images or content or information. And that's always stands out in a world where most people are copying. You know, something like 80%+ of pins are repins. So if you're doing something original, you're already ahead of the game. But I think the other thing is that it's in the thing that you said, he's showing people something useful. He's checking out a technology and talking about something that's useful to people. And we know from research that educational pins are incredibly popular on Pinterest. So if you're teaching people how to do something or you're educating them or you're enlightening them or you're giving them information that they want, that will make a pin, can make a pin very popular. And in fact, it can make a pin go viral.
Then you might have mentioned this earlier in another way, but leveraging the power of multimedia, giving people lots of stuff to look and watch and listen to.
Absolutely. So, you know, pins can be static images, you know, photographs or infographics, but they can also be videos. So you can pin a video, and when people click it, then they can see the video, or you can send them to your website to watch the video. So making your Pinterest multimedia with video and with audio, because you can also pin a podcast or you can pin an audio, that is part of how you make your Pinterest multimedia and get more interest and attention. And video right now, is one of the hottest things on the web. And so the more video you can incorporate, the better.
And once again, integrating with all your other social media.
Well, I think that's really the key to Pinterest, is you don't want it to stand on its own. You know, again, whenever I'm consulting with a small business on their marketing or their branding, one of the things I really try to do is to help them get an integration between their website and all their social media. So everything looks, feels, sounds, you know, is messaged the same. And so it's very important that if you have a blog, that you occasionally take your best blog post and you pin them to Pinterest with a great image. It's very important that when you have a great pin, you tweet it. It's very important, you know, that you have to have this cross between the platforms so that everything is sort of nurturing everything else. Now, that doesn't mean every pin gets Facebooked and tweeted and every tweet gets pinned. And, you know, it's not like that, but it's using discernment and discrimination, it's having this relationship between all of those things so that you do end up having cross-platform promotion, because you don't know who's going to see you where and then where that's going to lead to.
Well, Carol Leland, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
It has been my absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Karen Leland is the author of Entrepreneur Magazine's Ultimate Guide to Pinterest for Business. Tech Tuesday continues with Russell Holly from Geek.com when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Program support is provided by the Arts and College Prep Academy. ACPA is now enrolling high school students looking for a safe and vigorous learning environment for all. More information about ACPA can be found online at artcollegeprep.org.
Tell me the story of us.
Again? All right, Francis.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the new film Frances Ha with director Noah Baumbach and actress Greta Gerwig. It's about a young woman in the transition from college student to adult, dealing with relationships with both men and women that are often ambiguous and open-ended. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Your annual support of 89.7 NPR News is our largest source of income. Your gifts make up the funds we use to pay for the news you listen to every day. It's easy to renew your membership. Visit WOSU.org/renew or respond to our mailing by sending a generous check. Thank you for renewing your membership with 89.7 NPR News. You can discover more about WOSU Public Media by signing up for our WOSU FYI e-newsletter. Once you sign up, you'll receive a biweekly arts and culture e-newsletter featuring program highlights from radio and television, special event information, ticket offers, and much more. Just visit WOSU.org/email to sign up. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Tech Tuesday. Learning how to write computer code might very well be a good skill to have, but the learning curve can be pretty steep. That's why it could be a good idea to get kids thinking that way early on. The folks at MIT Media Lab had that in mind when they designed software for kids to learn coding called Scratch. A new version is out now, and here to tell us more about it is tech writer for Geek.com and parent, Russell Holly. Hi, Russell.
Hey there.
So, Scratch, when we're talking about kids, how young are we talking here now?
So, it really varies. It's really very much work with your child and see how comfortable they are embracing some of these topics. Scratch is built to be really, really simple, where, you know, you can be, a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old and kind of embrace some of these basic topics, or you can be, you know, an adult who has never done any programming in their life ever before or even considered it and still get something out of Scratch.
You've heard about these schools where they're advertising now 9-week courses in coding, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
What is the deal with coding? For people who don't know what coding is, this is actually writing out the computer directions.
This is programming. This is writing the applications that we use every day. And especially now that we live in this kind of weird world right now where we use a lot of these really small applications that do kind of really simple basic tasks on our phones and on web browsers and stuff now. So something like Scratch is great for really any age because it's a entry point that anyone can understand.
So the first version was released many years ago. How did it do? What's the difference?
So Scratch was released by MIT initially back in 2006, and it was just kind of a very simple educational system, but it focused really heavily on, targeting children. So there was a book that came out that went along with it. It was called The Super Scratch Programming Adventure, and you had a character that you followed along and did a lot of things with. But if you just used the MIT training tools, then it was really simple as well. What makes Scratch 2.0 different is really just that it's more powerful. You have a lot more control over, what you can do as far as editing visual, objects into the program that you've written, so that you can use, maybe pictures that you've taken yourself or graphics that you've made yourself in something like Photoshop or gotten from, a tool set or purchased or anything like that. But it gives you a lot more flexibility over the visual aspect of it.
So is this actually fun for kids or is it going to feel like homework?
So it really depends on how they're given, this approach. If they're sent to the MIT website for, just kind of a basic, here are the things to use and here's how you use them, then I can see it being kind of boring. Mm-hmm. But a lot of programming activists and parents who are programmers have worked really hard on things like the Super Scratch Adventure book that makes it a lot more fun for kids. And I've spent a little bit of time with it, not as much as I'd like to, with my oldest, mm-hmm. who is 7. And she's taken to it a lot, just kind of embracing the basic concepts of how you create a situation, where you line up events to reach an objective.
If you have a question or comment for Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page, post your question or comment there. Another option, tweet us at WOSU All Sides. You said program. You used the phrase programming activists. What do you mean by that?
Well, so you know, it's really hard to see people get into the computer services or information technology space. But you know, a lot of the people who do that are along the same level of knowledge as students who go to work at Best Buy, who go to repair computers and do things like that. And from a hardware perspective, or even from a networking or system administration perspective, that's really important things. But there are fewer and fewer programmers and system engineers and things like that every year. And so there are groups of people who focus really hard on teaching children and teaching young adults, how important it is to consider programming as a career path.
It sounds sort of empowering too.
It's definitely interesting. I've met a couple of them, over the past couple of years, and a lot of them are just really very high energy people and very education focused. They're real smart people.
Karen in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I have a question about what kind of hardware can you use this? Can you use Scratch on? iPad? Do you need a laptop or desktop?
Scratch, if you're looking at it from the perspective of the book, there's ebook versions of Super Scratch Adventure, and a lot of that can be done on paper.
Okay.
But the actual, programming and stuff, it's Scratch and then Python for kids and stuff like that. All typically require, either a Linux or a Mac, and I'm sorry, a Windows or a Mac environment, or Linux if you have it. So the iPad, there are Scratch tutorial things in the iOS store, and there are ways that you can kind of get around and use Scratch in that way. But really, a more traditional laptop or desktop is probably your best bet.
Okay. Thank you, Karen, for that question. You mentioned another program besides Scratch. So are there any other good programs? Can you repeat that one and, any others that you want to recommend?
Oh, so, if Scratch is something, if your child or if you personally get to a point where you think, Scratch is getting too easy or repetitive, there's a Python for Kids. Which is another, book-oriented educational tool that I thought was really great. I haven't quite moved to that point yet with my daughter, but definitely a great step forward.
Just tell her to grow up so you can start working on this stuff with her.
I know.
You also wanted to talk about Google Storage. Tell us what's new there.
So this is kind of exciting from the perspective of someone who uses a lot of Google's products.
Mm-hmm.
I use Google Drive and have since they unveiled it last year at Google I/O for kind of an office suite. And I've used Gmail since probably 2004. And I also use Google Plus, which allows you to take high resolution photos and upload them to the service instead of compressing them like Facebook and Twitter do. And as a result, that a lot of that stuff takes up a lot of space. So you have a lot of these services have different storage options across each one of them where you can get, up to 25 gigs on Gmail if you pay the extra, and Google Drive and G+ all have storage limits. But Google pulled all three of these services together into a single storage bin that you can allocate however you choose. So now everyone who has a Google account has 15 gigabytes of online storage that they can use however they want across Google Drive, Gmail, and Google Plus.
So does this mean more or less online storage for the average user? What's typical?
It's way more for the average user, and it's really dependent on what it is that you use. Dropbox is one of the more popular storage options, and they give you, 2 gigs free, whereas there are others like a Microsoft service gives you 7 gigs for free if you are a SkyDrive user. And there's a lot of options available to you, but this isn't just one application. This gives you the same cloud storage stuff that you get with Dropbox in Google Drive, but it also, if you're a heavy email user, then you don't have to pay for the extra for email. Or if you take a lot of photos like I do, then, you can store the high resolution version of the image on Google Plus as opposed to storing them on Facebook or Twitter, which compresses the image and makes it kind of a generally lower quality.
So what's in it for Google? Why did they do this?
Well, I imagine it probably makes it easier for them to manage, but it also allows them to offer a more competitive product against companies like Dropbox. You know, Dropbox is a really popular storage service, and they have the 2 gigabytes free, and then after that they start charging a monthly rate. And Google's storage prices are significantly better. You know, you can get 100 gigabytes that you can now share across these three services for $5 a month. Whereas, you know, for that same price for Dropbox, you're getting closer to, you know, 10 or 15 gigabytes.
So what's going to happen when I, hit the 15 gig limit?
When you hit the 15 gig limit, you can either clear out storage or you can opt to purchase additional storage. And you can purchase them in increments of 100 gigabytes for monthly fees.
Okay. Let's turn to BlackBerry. You just came from an event, BlackBerry Live. What was this?
So BlackBerry every year has a developer conference where they kind of talk about all the new stuff that they have going on. And this year in particular, with the release of the BlackBerry Z10 and the new BlackBerry 10 operating system and really kind of their whole corporate rebranding, you know, they had their developer conference to talk about some of the new stuff that they have and what they just got done announcing maybe 15, 20 minutes ago. Was that BlackBerry Messenger is coming out this summer for the iPhone and for Android.
And what will that do? Is that just
BlackBerry Messenger is a group messaging service that's been a huge part of BlackBerry for a really long time.
Okay.
It's allowed for group messaging. You can set up groups and you know, messaging is kind of persistent across all of your communication methods. And when you leave, you know, the BlackBerry ecosystem, which a lot of people have done just because, you know, the iPhone and Android phones have been, you know, kind of gradually improving while BlackBerry has kind of stayed behind a little bit. This new service is going to be available in the summer and is going to allow you to communicate not only with other BlackBerry members, but across iOS, Android, and BlackBerry all together, which isn't something that anybody really is doing right now.
Is this part of BlackBerry's, you know, we've talked about them branding, looking, you know, just reconnoitering overall. Is this part of all of that?
Absolutely. This is really kind of a bigger part of what's going on with BlackBerry trying to reach into the kind of consumer space. For the longest time, BlackBerry was, you know, government employees and businesses, and, you know, your BlackBerry was a statement that you were a professional, and that was, you know, kind of who you were. And they've been working really hard over the last couple of months, specifically since the relaunch in January, to approach consumer markets with, you know, a new app store that handles, you know, music and videos, and now this BlackBerry Messenger service, you know, that is more oriented towards, you know, conversation on fun levels, you know, with a channel service that works kind of like chat rooms that we used to have, you know, on specific topics are a big part of BlackBerry Messenger moving forward. And this, you know, this whole ecosystem they're trying to build now is, you know, shifting BlackBerry towards the consumer space while making sure that they don't lose some of the corporate and government, you know, audience that they've had for so long.
Have they continued to enjoy that audience, though, or has the corporate and government been going the way of?
So it's kind of both. I mean, corporate and government. Corporate definitely has been moving more towards a, you know, kind of a bring your own device thing where, you know, internal management tools for iOS and for Android have been good enough that the switch has been necessary. But especially in military installations, the Department of Defense has relied on BlackBerry for a really long time. And the encryption standards that have been in place on BlackBerry phones to allow for secure data to be transferred have kept them there for a long time. And it's only been very, very recently that the Department of Defense has even considered like Samsung or Apple, you know, as possible alternatives. But I think especially in that space, BlackBerry will be a big part of that for a long time.
Well, who knew? Government contracts. All right. So we've got a few extra minutes. What else?
So actually starting tomorrow, Google is going to have their big developer conference right behind BlackBerry with their Google I/O conference. And they're going to be doing a lot of pretty exciting stuff. There's some talk about new hardware coming and some new services around Google Plus and around their instant messenger service. Right now, Google kind of has, you know, Google Talk and Hangout Messenger and all of these different services that kind of do the same thing, but they don't talk very well together.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of speculation that Google is going to pull all of those services together, similarly to how they did with their storage system, and create, you know, one unified platform for communication across all of their devices.
We were talking about, I think it was you and I were talking about last week or the week before, Twitter. Was that you? Maybe not. But do you use Twitter, right?
I use Twitter pretty occasionally. It's kind of hard for me to, I really don't like the character limit. So
okay.
it's hard for me to, I talk too much, I guess. So it's hard for me to stick with 140 characters when I want to say something.
Somehow that all makes sense. But I do see that you do use it. Do you use TweetDeck?
I do not use TweetDeck.
Okay.
I try to use the official Twitter application just because it's the same across all of the phones and tablets that I play with.
Okay. And okay, so you like that. I was just wondering what you think of TweetDeck.
TweetDeck was definitely – I have used TweetDeck before, and when I used it, it was really great for kind of a mass organization, especially on the desktop. It
mm-hmm.
felt more like a proper communication tool for you know, deep kind of exploratory conversations. Like if you wanted to have a conversation about a specific topic, you could break that out into a separate tab on TweetDeck and have that conversation over there,
right?
Which was, you know, really kind of a powerful tool. But not something that I think most regular Twitter users would take advantage of.
Okay. Anything else?
I don't, you know, the big thing moving forward this week is going to be the stuff that's going to be going on with Google and BlackBerry just did their thing.
Mm-hmm.
Really, I think I would like to talk within the next couple of weeks about some of the stuff that we talked about a little while ago about kind of solar charging stuff.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of really exciting stuff coming out for car mounts and stuff where you can charge the phone wirelessly and at the same time use a solar connection to do so. So I kind of want to see if I can go, you know, maybe days or even a week on nothing but solar energy.
Okay.
So that's something I'm going to talk about soon.
All right. And let's think of things for Father's Day, too, coming up.
Absolutely.
All right. Great. Russell Halley, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
It's Russell Halley, tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks, as always, to the All-Side staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karam Shaban, Shannon Clary, Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks so much for joining us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.com. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.